All right, everybody, here we go again for yet another Tech Doctor podcast. How you doing this time around, Allison?
I am doing great. I am just kind of sitting here marveling through the fact that we are racing at breakneck speed through February. It's almost March.
It's crazy.
It's almost birthday month and CSUN month, and we're going to Vegas and all kinds of fun stuff coming up in March.
March is a big month.
It's a huge month.
Is your birthday in March?
Yeah, the 15th.
Ooh,
yeah.
Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Means I'm going to see you shortly after your birthday.
After. Yeah, you'll have to buy me a birthday beer.
I will. We're excited about CSUN. We're doing a presentation there on podcasting, so that's going to be a lot of fun.
It's going to be so much fun. I'm really excited.
Yeah. Well, today I have a variety of things that I'd like to discuss with you and get your thoughts and feelings about. And okay. So let's just jump right in and go through a couple of items that I've seen on the blogosphere lately. I usually hear about these things through Twitter and then go check out the articles. And the first one was kind of interest to me. There's a blogger who does a blog called Marco's Accessibility Blog. He talks about how he has decided after 5 years of using the Mac, he's going to switch back to using Windows. And he does begin by describing how excited he was about VoiceOver in the Mac and about what a great idea he thought it was that the operating system had accessibility built in and so forth. But he feels that over the years, for various reasons, the Mac has begun meeting his needs less well. And part of it is that he uses Braille with his Mac, and I believe he said his first language was German. And so using German Braille apparently isn't working as well as he would like it to on the Mac. And he also was not satisfied anymore with web browsing on the Mac. And I, you know, am not where he's at as far as web browsing. I do use both Safari, and I also use Internet Explorer with System Access on my Windows computer at work. And there are things sometimes that I find a little easier to do on a given page with Safari, and sometimes a little easier to do with Internet Explorer and System Access. And then sometimes I find something that literally won't play, like a Flash item that literally won't play with Internet Explorer, but I can get it to play on the Mac and vice versa sometimes. So I guess I'm preferring the overall VoiceOver Safari interface to the Internet Explorer interface, but he does raise some interesting points. And I think the main thing that I got out of this article, really in a lot of ways, is that even though he has decided to make the switch back, it still seems to me that it's pretty subjective. And that really, as it always comes down to, you got to try them both and see which one works best for you. I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
Well, I agree. It was more or less subjective, but there was one thing that I remember him saying that kind of threw me for a bit of a loop. He basically made the statement that Apple does not care about accessibility, and I don't think that's entirely what he meant. I mean, I don't want to put words into Marco's mouth. I have a great respect for him, and I follow him on Twitter and everything. He's a great guy, but I was perplexed by that statement because nothing is further from the truth.
Yeah, that would be a statement that I would have to disagree with in the article. I think there's just evidence from Tim Cook mentioning accessibility fairly recently in a speech to some changes looks like we'll be seeing made to VoiceOver accessibility when the next version of Mavericks comes out. Yeah. Every time a beta is released to developers lately, there's been a statement saying, please test this or that.
Test VoiceOver.
With yeah. VoiceOver. So I think that maybe somehow some of the things that Marco is wanting to do on the Mac are not working the way he would like them to, and I certainly can understand that. What I will be really curious about, though, is after 6 months of using Windows, I would be surprised if he doesn't have an equally troubling list of things that he's at least somewhat dissatisfied with Windows accessibility.
I would wonder that too, because no operating system is perfect. No operating system is going to offer the optimal, beautiful, bright, sunshiny accessibility experience 100% of the time. There's going to be problems no matter which path you choose.
Well, one of the things about Windows these days, honestly, at least in my experience, you just about have to use multiple screen readers to get full accessibility because different screen readers have their own strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, on my virtual machine, I have JAWS, System Access, NVDA, and WindowEyes to do the very few things now that I need to do with Windows, which are lessening by the day. I find myself gravitating, at least at home, more towards the Mac and iOS side of things exclusively. But yeah, even for the few little things that I find myself needing Windows for every now and then, four screen readers, four. And yeah. Only one on the Mac and iOS.
And the problem is that with four screen readers, you've got four sets of commands to remember.
Yep. And there's the issue of doing Windows commands on the Mac side and Mac commands on the Windows side, which is an entirely different issue.
So even for nerds like you and I, who on some level love learning screen reader commands, it can get to be a bit much, really.
Yes, it really can, even for a geek.
Yeah. We had an interesting article come up in the last couple weeks, which is a revision of an article that he wrote earlier. Chris Hofstetter wrote an article where he spent 3 months working with an Android tablet, and he was really trying to determine what the level of accessibility is like on Android. And he also had someone working with him who was a person who is deafblind, who was using Braille exclusively. And he found that the Braille access for the deafblind person was really lacking on the Android side. And when he began to dig into this whole accessibility issue more, and he comes at it from the point of view of a programmer and a software engineer, he reports that he has discovered that Google has failed to provide many of the standard accessibility hooks in Android that are available in iOS, OS X, Windows, most other operating system that currently support some form of accessibility. And he describes a couple of these hooks that are missing in the accessibility API from Google. And so, you know, I'm not a software developer, and so I have to sort of have to take Chris's word on some of this as being the truth, but it sounds correct. And he even went back and corrected some mistakes that he had made in the earlier version of this article because he got feedback from other people. So I felt like he's trying really hard to be fair and honest about the reality of what exists here. And it certainly explains some things to me because I hear so often from developers that it's much more difficult for them to make applications accessible as an Android app than as an iOS app. And so I'm just giving a bit of a shame on you to Google on this one, because I think they should step up and do a better job with building the hooks into Android that developers need to really make better accessibility. I don't know if you have thoughts about that.
I do, and I want to say good on you, Chris, for bringing this to the light of day and for taking Google to task, because I don't think enough people do that. I think that there is enough of a solid, you know, people talk about Apple fanboys and fangirls, and perhaps we are those types of people, but there are just as many blindly, if you will, blindly loyal Android fan people who don't seem to be taking Google to task for the things that are still wrong in terms of accessibility with the operating system. And I want there to be choice. Yes, my operating system of choice right now is iOS, but I do have an Android tablet. There are some things I enjoy doing on it. I think I could enjoy doing more things on it if accessibility was fixed a little bit. To me, it's still a very clunky, I've said this before, a very clunky user experience. And I want that to change because I want us to have choices. I am passionate about that. And I think it's great that Chris is taking Google to task, and hopefully this will start a firestorm of change. I hope so. I want to see that.
Yeah, I would hope that will too. I'm not real optimistic about it because it kind of suggests to me that Google isn't taking it that seriously, and it'd be nice if they would have a change of heart somehow, or if they would devote more resources to it. Certainly they have the engineering talent and the resources to do this.
Exactly. And I'm not usually one to encourage advocacy organizations like the NFB or ACB to really step up. I'm pretty darn apolitical when it comes to the advocacy type stuff. But come on, guys, get on Google here. You know, I think the protest in front of Amazon may have made a difference. I think this kind of fire is what's needed. And I think more people feel it than are willing to admit it. And we all have to kind of come together and actively do what we can to enact change here.
Absolutely, and I hope that will happen. It does in some ways explain to me some things that I've been feeling, which is something that you mentioned, that for whatever reason, Android accessibility just feels clunky to me. And I think it's because developers don't really have the tools that they need to make it work really, really well. This really needs to change, I think.
I agree.
I want to move on now to talking a little bit about a couple of books that I've been reading lately, currently am in the process of reading, because I think they're kind of interesting to people who listen to this podcast, perhaps. The first one I want to mention, I don't even know exactly when it came out, but I think sometime last year. The book is called The Circle. The author is Dave Eggers, E-G-G-E-R-S. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, Dave. Sorry about that. But anyway, the book is available. I got it off of Bookshare, and it's quite an interesting book. It's about a company, a fictional company called The Circle. And this company is, I guess, sort of like the modern day Google in a sense, except Google to the extreme, or maybe you could plug Facebook in there, and maybe you could even plug Apple in there a little bit. But this is a high-tech company that has created an operating system that is a single sign-on operating system. When you sign into it, everything from every corner of your life is brought into this system. Your medical records, your social networking history, everything is brought into under this one umbrella. And so you can actually view every part of yours and everyone else's internet life on this system. And this company is all about managing this huge conglomeration that everyone essentially in the world is encouraged to sign into, subscribe to. And it's so fascinating because there's a young woman who goes to work for this company. She's in customer service, and you just gradually see, she starts out extremely excited about this whole possibility, and you can just gradually see how having no privacy, having no ability to keep up with the millions of messages that she gets that she's expected to respond to, the invitations that she gets she's expected to respond to, so on and so forth. It's so fascinating to read this two-sided, double-edged story about the advances of technology and the serious problems as far as privacy and rights to individuality and things like that go. So I won't say more. I don't want to give any more than that away, but the book is called The Circle, and it's really an interesting one.
That sounds fascinating. Is it only available on Bookshare?
I didn't look for it anywhere else. I would be surprised if it's not on Audible. And I don't know about Bard.
I have to say I've become kind of a snob in terms of my reading. One of the great things now about us having so many choices is that we oftentimes now have the choice between text-to-speech and actual narrated audio. And I have to say I've become one of those people who kind of prefers the narrated audio.
Yeah, I understand that. I would like to say just a couple things about that. One is that what I really love Bookshare for is a lot of these books that I read on Bookshare, I read them in Braille. The other thing, I don't know whether you probably have, but there is a really great voice now. I think his name is James.
James, yeah, I love James.
I haven't heard anybody, any synthetic voice to me that reads quite as well as he does.
I agree, and he's really good at high speed, too.
The second book that I wanted to mention is, I'm reading it as an Audible book, and it's just a wonderful book. It's gotten a lot of attention on a couple of the book podcasts that I subscribe to, but it's called The Martian, and it's by Andy Weir, W-E-I-R. And it's such a cool book because it's about a man who was an astronaut. He was on a mission to Mars. An accident happened, and the rest of the crew assumes that he's dead and has to exit Mars because of this accident. They have to exit in a real hurry, and they leave him behind. And so this guy has to survive, and it looks like he's going to have to try to survive on Mars for 4 years until the next mission can pick him up. So the way that he goes about it is just absolutely fascinating. And
man,
it's just one of the coolest books ever. So I encourage anyone who has any interest at all in space exploration and just sort of that sciencey side of what someone would fictionally imagine it be like to try to survive on Mars, this is a really cool book to check out.
So, and I will.
And I bet you will. And I just bet you'll enjoy it. We might come back and talk about this book later after you've had a chance to read it, because it is really cool. And I just wanted to send a shout out to the developer of the I Read It Now app, which is an app that you and I both use to keep track of the books that we're reading.
Yep.
And it lets you not only write down and keep tracks of the books that you read and the books that you want to read, but it also gives you a very nice statistical screen where you can see how many books you read in a given month or over a given year or whatever. And it's just, I've had so much fun with this app. But unfortunately, while the iPhone app is perfectly accessible, the version for the iPad had some accessibility issues. Some parts of it you just couldn't access, at least not very easily, with VoiceOver. And I wrote this developer, and he wrote me back and said that he would make VoiceOver fully accessible on the iPad when he had time. And it's only been a couple months, and recently I got a note from him, an email from him, saying that the version that was coming into the App Store would be fully accessible with VoiceOver on the iPad, and sure enough, it is. So
excellent.
You know, you just the Apple community of developers, a lot of them are small businesses, maybe one or two, or you know, less than a half a dozen people working on something, and because it's sort of this mom and pop kind of operation, I find so many of these people extremely open to doing what they need to do to make their apps fully accessible. And
that's what I found too.
Yeah, and that's just exciting to me because I don't know of any, I've never seen this kind of community in any of the other operating systems. And it's one of the things I love about iOS and Apple, frankly.
Yeah.
Same thing's also true, I think, in many cases on the Mac side. We've certainly seen it with Downcast and other apps like that.
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk a bit about online backups. And for those of you who have been listening to for a while, probably know that I'm fanatical about backing up my computers. I do it every Sunday morning. I I do a clone backup to SuperDuper onto a portable USB hard drive. I have Time Machine running, which is doing a backup all the time of the two Macs here in the house. And I have, for the last couple of years, realized that the missing element for me is some sort of offsite backup, because your even your clone backups on your USB hard drives don't do you any good if your house burns down and the drive's in there. And that's unlikely that's going to happen. Or, you know, if someone breaks in and steals your hard drives, or who knows.
Or if the hard drive fails.
Yeah. Well, I've got two of them, so I am somewhat covered there. But yes, if the hard drive fails. The last few months, I decided to get a lot more serious about investigating online backups. And there is a really great book out from TakeControlBooks.com called Backing Up Your Mac. Or I think it's actually called Take Control of Backing Up Your Mac.
Yep, and it's a good book.
It's a good book, and it does go through the pros and cons of the more popular online backup systems. And a lot of people that I know and follow and keep track of and listen to their podcast use a backup system called CrashPlan, which is very popular in the Apple community. And I think CrashPlan is a great system, and it offers some things that are unique to it. As far as I can tell, it's not ideal from an accessibility standpoint. Number one, for me, it requires Java to be installed on your Mac, and I don't have Java installed on my MacBook. Even if you have Java installed, there are some accessibility issues with the CrashPlan app. So I wasn't thrilled about CrashPlan, but then one of the other online services that a lot of the geeks use to back up their Apple devices, and they also can back up Windows devices too, is from a company called Backblaze. And I wrote Backblaze an email just saying, does your Backblaze system, is it accessible? Does it work with VoiceOver? And I didn't know at the time what I would get back, but they almost immediately wrote me back and said, yes, our Mac version is fully compatible with VoiceOver, and so is our iOS app that runs on the iPhone. So I decided to give Backblaze a try, and it's a really interesting system because it was developed by two people who were former Apple engineers. So these folks really know how to develop Mac software, Apple software. And they also didn't want people to hassle with the backup. So Backblaze is very automated. When you download the installer from their site, it puts a Backblaze preference item in the OS X system preferences. It just creates a preference pane for Backblaze. It doesn't actually install anything in the applications folder. And it immediately goes into a trial mode. I believe it's a 15-day trial. And immediately starts backing up the important items on your computer. Now, and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to tell it what to back up. It figures it out. It does not back up your applications, and it does not back up the operating system. But it does back up things like your documents, your music, your photos, things that you would want to preserve. I don't really want it backing up the operating system. I have other ways of reinstalling that if I have to. I don't need it to back up my applications. I have other ways of getting them back if I need to. So I'm happy with what Backblaze backs up. You can exclude folders from the backup if you want. Like if you got a folder of movies, for example, or something that you don't want it to back up. Because what happens is it uploads all of the files on your computer to the Backblaze servers. And for most of us, at least in the US, uploading is a problem because for those of us who use cable modems especially, almost all the cable providers give us much slower upload speeds than download speeds.
Yep.
And so I found that Backblaze really slowed down my network while it was doing the initial upload of my hard drive. And you can take some control over that if you need to. You can go into the preferences and tell Backblaze to throttle back and use less bandwidth. But the problem with that is the more you throttle it back, the longer it's going to take to get the data from this hard drive up to their servers. So I actually left it at the defaults and put up with some sluggishness on my network. And I mean, I could really notice that it was taking web pages, for example, a lot longer to open when the backup was running. You can also pause the backup. So if you pause it, then it'll say, okay, backup paused, we'll resume, you know, maybe an hour and a half from now. It'll give you a time that it's going to resume, so you don't have to remember to restart it. It'll restart itself. But
nice.
But you can pause it if you need that bandwidth to do something else. So I found that on my system, I don't have that much data, honestly. A couple hundred gigs, I guess, or so of data. It took 8-10 days, and my computer's not always on. This is a MacBook Pro, so sometimes the lid's closed and it's asleep, and Backblaze can't back up when it's asleep, I don't believe. But at any rate, it took about 8 or 10 days for my entire hard drive to get backed up. And as soon as it got backed up completely, then Backblaze just goes into this mode where it does incremental backups. And every once in a while, it just checks in to see which files have changed since the last backup and fixes the backup to be current with the latest file. So anything that was deleted from your hard drive, it gets deleted from the backup. Anything that was added, gets added. And I've found that this process is completely unobtrusive. I don't notice any change in my bandwidth availability or anything when it's doing these incremental touch-up type backups. So point is, Backblaze works completely in the background once you get the initial backup done, which will take up some bandwidth. And for you, it would be right now where you are, it'd be a big problem because of your not having good Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I'm going to have to wait until we move, which will hopefully be happening sooner than later.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hope so. So that is one thing people should keep in mind, that it does help if you have and I have a pretty fast cable connection, although my upload speeds are really throttled back way slower than my download speeds. And so this is the reason why it feels so bandwidth intensive. It's not Backblaze's fault. It's the cable company's fault.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Backblaze has gotten some negative criticism for is the way it handles the restoration of backed up files. And let me explain just briefly how that works. It suits me fine, but it probably wouldn't suit some people. If you need to restore a file or some files from your backup, when you go into the restore option on the computer, on the Mac, what you end up actually doing is logging into the Backblaze website, and you can see your hard drive and see the various folders, and then you can drill down and see the files within the folders on the website. You can select the files that you want to restore, and then once that happens, when you have selected the files and you choose to restore them, Backblaze will actually zip those files into an archive and email them as an attachment to you. And so then it's up to you to take those archive files and put them back on your computer where you wanted them. So it doesn't restore them to their original place. You have to do that yourself. And that's actually okay with me, but it may not be okay with some people. If you had a catastrophic failure, like if your hard drive, you know, it was completely dead, and you had to, and you, the only backup you had was from Backblaze, and you had to restore the whole thing from there. They do offer an option for an additional cost where they will either send you a USB hard drive with all of your data on it, or they will allow you, I believe, at lesser cost to send them a USB hard drive. They'll put your data on it and send it back to you. So that's how restoring works on the computer. Now, on the iPhone, it's interesting. You can log into your Backblaze account through their Backblaze iPhone app, and you can see every folder and every file that's on your computer. And of course, you can do this from anywhere in the world that you have an internet connection. And so when you find a file that you want, you can double tap on it. It'll simply download that file into the Backblaze app on your iPhone. Then you have the usual options of being able to share the file. So like you could send it to Dropbox at that point, or you could attach it to an email and email it to yourself or someone else. You can do things like that. And also, if you just want to access the file, if it's a music file, an MP3 file, or a text file, something like that, you can just open it right there in the Backblaze app and read the file or listen to the music or whatever you want to do. So the beauty of it is that the iPhone app, as is the Mac app and the website, works fully well with VoiceOver. There are no unlabeled buttons. On the iPhone app, you can't flick to the done button. When you're done looking at a file, you have to actually find that button on the screen. But when you double tap on it, the file goes away and it goes back to the regular list of files that the app shows you. But I'm really happy with Backblaze, and I think it's a great solution for anyone who is looking for an accessible online backup system. So I just want to talk a little bit about it.
Nice, I'm going to check it out.
Yeah, I would recommend you do check it out if you're interested in that kind of thing. It's relatively inexpensive. It costs $5 per month per computer, and you can have multiple computers on one account if you want. And that's if you pay month to month, $5 a month per computer. If you are willing to pay for a year or 2 years worth of backups in advance, you can get that cost down to just a little bit under $4 for computer per month. So it's, you know, that's not so bad for what you're getting, I don't think.
No, I think it's awesome.
You can log into your Backblaze account from any computer anywhere in the world, as long as you have your password, and see your files and access your files. So just kind of nice to know that, you know, if you were somewhere and you needed a file that was on your computer that had been backed up by Backblaze, there is a way to get to it, even if your computer's not with you.
Excellent.
Yeah, so I'm kind of excited about online backup, and I'm very excited about how accessible it is. Hats off to Backblaze for doing a great job on accessibility. I want to move and talk a little bit about RSS, and for people who don't know, that's really simple syndication, and it's a way of aggregating information from various websites into one place so that you can easily see articles that have been written on your favorite topics without having to search from website to website. And we did something on RSS last year with Kunal, who had developed an app called Lear, which is a really great RSS app for the iPhone. And I'm still excited about Lear because it's one of the only RSS apps that I've ever seen that goes ahead and retrieves the text of all the articles and downloads them so that you can use the app when you're not online, when you're not connected to the internet, and still read your information. But I got to the point where I really wanted all of my RSS feeds to be in sync on my iPhone, my iPad, and my Mac. And so started looking at other alternatives. Prior to last year, a lot of people used the free Google Reader to keep their RSS feeds in sync across devices. But Google Reader is no more. It ceased to exist. So now you pretty much need to pay for a service that essentially does the same thing that Google Reader did. And I decided on a service called Feed Wrangler at feedwrangler.com. It costs about $20 a year. And essentially what it does is it keeps all your RSS feeds in sync. It's nice if you're moving to Feed Wrangler from Lear, you can simply have Lear export an OPML file containing all your feeds, and then you can import that OPML file into Feed Wrangler, and so you don't have to re-enter your feeds by hand. They'll just all be there once you do that import. So one of the things that's really great about Feed Wrangler is it supports some very nice applications for the other devices. I just want to mention the three that I'm currently really enjoying that are very accessible. The first one is an app for the iPhone called Unread, and it's a new app that is apparently very beautiful as far as the visual interface goes, but they also said in the release notes that it was voiceover compatible, and it is. But you have to learn a couple new gestures, or at least to use a couple gestures in a different way than what you're used to. The good news is, though, that when you first run the app, it instructs you on how these gestures work with voiceover, if you're running voiceover. So it's a really nice app. It really works very well. It's just a lovely interface to use with voiceover on the iPhone to read your RSS feeds. And of course, it signs into Feed Wrangler. And on the Mac, I'm using an app that I really like a lot. It is one of the most voiceover friendly apps I've used in a long time. And that's saying a lot because most of them work well. But this one's called ReadKit, and it's available in the Mac App Store. And it is so nice because the voiceover command, voiceover J, lets you jump between the table, which lists the feeds, the title of the article, and the thumbnail sketch of the article. You can jump between that and the actual article itself using VoJ, and there are shortcut keys built into the app that let you do things like open the article in a browser, and it's just beautiful to work with VoiceOver. There's even a shortcut key that lets you jump. The letter J lets you jump to the next article, and the letter K moves you back to the previous article. So it's just beautiful for you working with VoiceOver. That's ReadKit on the Mac. And on the iPad, I use one called Mr. Reader, which is very nice. It's very accessible. A little different interface, a little bit to get used to. But again, all the RSS feeds are in sync across all three of these devices. So just want to pass that along. And don't know whether you do much with RSS these days or not, but this is a nice way to go for people.
I want to do more RSS because I'm signed up for the Loop. And a premium member of Daring Fireball, and I want to do more with checking my RSS feeds. But my question to you is, do any of these apps support push notifications? Because that would help me so much. I know with Downcast, the only reason I remember half the time to listen to an episode is because I get a push notification saying that, you know, four new episodes were detected in this podcast. And is there anything comparable to that in any of these RSS readers?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
For the final topic, and I realize we've gone on much longer here than I expected, but I hope this has been worthwhile information. I want to talk just a little bit about sort of the iOS issue as compared to using specialized book players to play books and articles and, you know, electronic information. And I got excited about this topic again because of the announcement of the update to the second generation Victor Stream, which is offering a very nice internet radio interface, which is actually using the uTunes database. And Utunes is an app that was written for iOS for the iPhone. It's an iPhone radio app that works really great with VoiceOver. In fact, it's one of the first radio apps that I remember as being really, really accessible with VoiceOver.
Me too.
So it's nice that HumanWare has chosen the Utunes database to work with, because it is crammed full of really good internet radio stations. I think that's a big plus for the Victor stream. Also, they've added the ability to download content wirelessly from NFB Newsline. Again, there's a very nice NFB Newsline app for iOS. And they also are able to now wirelessly download books from Bookshare. And again, you know, we have a parity with that on iOS with VoiceStream, which can download straight from Bookshare. There's also a Bookshare app. What's that one called? Read2Go, maybe?
Read2Go. I haven't used it in ages, though. Yeah.
Yeah, I deleted it from my phone, preferring VoiceStream.
Yeah.
But so there certainly are apps to do what's being done on the Victor Reader stream. And yet, the demos that I've heard, I don't own the stream, so I can't speak from personal experience, but the demos that I've heard from people that I trust makes it seem like it is a very, very nice interface, a very easy-to-use interface to get to these radio stations and books from Bookshare and information from NFB Newsline, things like that. So I think it's a quite impressive way to go. There are a couple things that are still frustrating to me about this approach. The first one is that, and I don't know this for sure because I don't have a unit to try, but I did read the manual yesterday for the new Victor Reader stream, and I cannot find any evidence that the Wi-Fi that's built into the stream will log into a WPA2 Enterprise network. And that's what we have at the university. And Enterprise is different in that it requires one to be able not just to fill in a network key as your password, but it also requires a username and a password. So I don't know that the stream supports WPA2 Enterprise, and I'll be very pleasantly surprised to find out if it does, if indeed it does. But the other devices that are specialized that I've used don't support it. So it would be frustrating to have this Wi-Fi capability but not be able to use it in my work situation. And I think that if that turns out to be the case, would be unfortunate. The second thing that honestly I've found a bit frustrating is that you can't apparently activate the stream to work with Audible unless you have a Windows machine that can load the Audible manager. And so there was nothing mentioned at all in the manual about the Mac, working with the stream on the Mac. The stream companion software doesn't work with the Mac, or at least if it does, there was no mention of it in the manual. So I assume that means it's only Windows software. In fact, they talk about it as being Windows software. So those things are kind of frustrating to me. And the final thing that was frustrating to me was I saw it in the advertising literature, and I've heard some people say how much easier this interface is than the touchscreen interface. And I don't think that's quite fair. I mean, I think if you don't know how to use a touchscreen or don't want to use a touchscreen, or if there's some physical dexterity issue that keeps you from using a touchscreen, then I fully agree that the stream is easier to use in that situation. But for someone who is familiar with iOS and familiar with using touchscreens, I just don't know that I would automatically say it's easier. What do you think about that?
I now, when I go back to anything that has like a button interface, like something like a Stream or a BookSense, and I don't own one anymore, but I almost find that I'm more all thumbs with the buttons. I find that I'm more able to access things more fluidly via the touchscreen. And I feel personally, and this is just my opinion, I feel that the specialized book players are dying a very slow, painful, agonizing, screeching death. I really do. I mean, just look at what, I mean, I commend Humanware for what they've done in terms of bringing U-Tunes to the stream for the people currently who still prefer that type of technology. But it almost seems like, hey, look, we can be just as cool as the iPhone 2. Look at us, you know? And I feel like the specialized book players are trying to play a really, really futile game of catch-up. And one of the arguments for the specialized book players is that there will always be people, particularly elderly folks, who prefer the buttons of something like the Victor Reader Stream. But I'm finding, at least in my work and in my interactions with blind people on an almost daily basis, that a lot of older blind people, middle-aged to older, are switching, especially now that we have the Bard app, to the iPhone and ditching the old specialized players, in the case of the Stream, the new old specialized player.
Yeah. Well, I fully agree with you, and I definitely highlight your point about there is a need for these players at this point, I believe, for someone who can't or is not comfortable using a touchscreen. And I'm okay with that. And in fact, you know, when I heard the demo of how nice the interface was, I think I tweeted something like, boy, I'm holding on to my wallet here, because it seems to be very well done. It seems to be a very attractive, very simple to use interface. But when I really started thinking hard about it and digging into it, you know, there are some things that I really have come to enjoy on iOS that are not there on the Stream. For example, we have many more choices of text-to-speech voices in Voice Stream, for example, than are available on the Stream. We have the ability on iOS to download books directly from Bard or directly from Audible using the Audible mobile website, or, you know, not to mention the fact that the Kindle books and the Nook books are not available on the Stream. And finally, the thing that I would really miss were I to choose to use a Stream for this reading option is the fact that iCloud has done such a great job of letting people keep information in sync across devices. And so on the Audible app, for example, I can switch between my iPad and my iPhone and pick up the book wherever I left off on the other device. And we don't yet have that capability. I don't believe we do in the Bard app, but I've heard that might be coming at some point. And it's not an issue, really, unless you have multiple devices. I granted, that's true. But, you know, on iOS, we do have U-Tunes, which is on the Stream, essentially. But we also have TuneIn Radio and iBlink Radio and many other radio apps that open out the options even further. So I don't know. I was excited about it, and I think, you know, I'm really glad that a device like that, I believe the current Stream is priced at $369 US, and you know, that's not a terrible price for a nice player like that. But it's about the same price, isn't it, that you could get an iPod Touch?
Mm-hmm.
I believe.
I think a 64 gig iPod Touch is $399.
So, and you know, that's a lot of storage.
Mm-hmm.
So, in terms of even price-wise, you know, iOS is quite compatible with where the stream is. And so I'm not anti-stream. I'm not anti
humanware
at all. I applaud them for what they've done. But I do think that a wise consumer should think long and hard about, you know, is the learning curve of using a touchscreen or whatever inconvenience you may feel from using a touchscreen, which I don't at this point really feel any inconvenience, and sounds like you don't either. But for those who do, you really got to think about, is that inconvenience worth the things that you're giving up and the limitations that you come upon if you choose to go the specialized book player route?
And, you know, one of the things that you mentioned was people with dexterity issues who legitimately may have a lot of trouble with the touchscreen. But just the other day, I was reading about a device, and I, for the life of me, can't remember what it's called. It's in my Twitter favorites. But I think it was just a prototype at this point of a button interface, and I think it connected via Bluetooth, like a 5-button interface for iOS devices, and I think they're also working on switch access for people with severe motor physical issues. So technology that is going to allow access to these mainstream devices is very much coming to the forefront at this point and being developed, and hopefully will catch on. So again, it just kind of proves my point that like we've both said, I really applaud HumanWare for being there for the consumer right now, but I hope that they as a company will be able to see where the wind is blowing and shift their development efforts accordingly.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. And so we will see how this all works out. And I hope that we've been fair in our discussion here on all these topics, and you know, please give us your feedback if you have feedback. But I mean, I'm interested in discussing things, but not in putting companies or people or operating systems or anything down.
For
what they're doing, but to make fair points, at least as we see them, about the current state of the art, the current situation of things.
And we love our companies, and we want our companies to stay relevant and to stay current, and quite frankly, to stay in business. And that's my reason for such strong feelings in a lot of ways.
It's interesting to think about how they will go about that. You know, apparently GW Micro has gotten very creative in that, and somehow working a deal with Microsoft so they can provide WindowEyes at no charge on any computer that's running Microsoft Office 2010 or later.
And I think that's genius, absolute genius.
And so they found a way to probably hugely increase the market share, the popularity of WindowEyes, and you know, good for them for coming up with that. But these companies are going to really have to get creative.
Yep.
I think HIMSS has done a nice job of it so far, in that they have offered on their Braille devices so many of the popular applications, such as Dropbox and RSS, and the ability to read Excel spreadsheets, things like that. They've offered those applications in a Braille environment. We have gone on way longer than I intended to, so I want to bring this to a close, and want to invite everyone who wants to comment to be sure to send us an email at techdoctor@dr-carter.com, and let us hear your comments. And we'll be talking more about some of these issues, I'm sure, as 2014 rolls along. So for now, this is Robert, the Tech Doctor. I will say so long.
And this is Allison Hartley saying bye, everyone.